Thank you. It's exciting to see so many attendees at a late afternoon session. So this work began when I was a postdoc working with Dr. Satcher at Morehouse School of Medicine, and Mercedes and our co-presenter, Oriana, were students at Spelman College. This study also stems from work in 2011 when several partners in Southwest Atlanta were interested in bringing a Safe Routes to School initiative, particularly in an urban neighborhood in Southwest Atlanta. And these partners included a local community development corporation, the State Department of Transportation, Kaiser Permanente, and several local universities. However, parents and youth were not engaged and were not at the table, and they were and are the end users. So we wondered, what does this mean? Oh, sorry, we do not have any disclosures to disclose this time. So we wondered, what does this mean for young people living in an urban neighborhood, much like the urban neighborhoods in Philadelphia and in Detroit that we just heard about, particularly in Southwest Atlanta when more than 50% of the houses are foreclosed upon? So we've heard a lot of questions about what does this mean for abandoned homes. So we feel that a historical framework is very important when thinking about the social determinants of health and for contemporary public health issues. In the case of Atlanta, some of our scholars refer to what is known as the Atlanta paradox. So on one hand, Atlanta is thought to be an excluded Southern other, very politically regressive, very conservative, with tons of racial segregation, and in a public health lens, what our environmental justice colleagues call a riskscape. On the other hand, Atlanta is also seen to be exceptional, racially progressive, thought to be part of the New South, part of the industrial progress, part of globalization, as well as, quote unquote, the city too busy to hate, which we'll talk about in a minute, a term coined in 1960 by then Mayor Hartsfield to respond to student activism at the time in the civil rights movement. It's also known to be a mecca for black people across the diaspora. And particularly a safe haven. It was a safe haven at the end of the Civil War and a safe haven at the end of the Civil Rights Movement. In 1895, Booker T. Washington coined a speech that later became known as the Atlanta Compromise. And during the speech, he was actually the first African-American man to speak in a racially integrated context in the South. And he championed, or he called for and advocated for blacks to receive basic education and due processes before the law. But some critics cite that this was a compromise because he advocated for vocational industrial training instead of liberal arts education, as well as activism at the time. He, though, thought that through hard work and industrious labor, blacks could achieve full citizenship. In the effort to achieve full citizenship, blacks did end up migrating to Atlanta and to the urban South. Now, during the keynote at APHA, we heard Professor Wilkerson talk about migration. A lot of my other work really is about this migration across the United States from the South to the West Coast, the Midwest, and the Northeast. But it's also important to remember that there was also internal state migration and regional migration. And so in the case of Atlanta, many migrants were coming from the rural South, moving to these urban centers across the South, such as Atlanta. And they were really fleeing lynching and mob violence going on in the rural South and in hopes of achieving this citizenship that Booker T. Washington talked about. Now, Du Bois at this time cautioned against the black middle class, the black bourgeoisie, fleeing in the hopes of achieving mobility and in hopes of achieving capitalism and materialism, because he thought that this would compromise other parts of the black community and not just the middle class. In 1906, the Atlanta race riots happened, really stemming from rising racial tension at this time, where between 25 and 40 blacks were killed and two white residents were killed in Atlanta. And this really also shifted the housing patterns in Atlanta. So black people began to become segregated. They were forced to be segregated because of their race, but they also felt safer living in ethnic enclaves in Atlanta. Also during this time, although black populations were segregated, black meccas began to spring up in cities, and main streets began to thrive. So you had thriving businesses, you had thriving communities across socioeconomic status. So you have the Sweet Auburn Avenue, you have the Hunter Street in Atlanta. In the neighborhood where we did our work, in the neighborhood of Pittsburgh, you had McDaniel Street. Now, by 1920s, McDaniel Street was known as the Avenue. And this was a 10-block stretch that was a central place for businesses, and 95% of those businesses were owned by residents of the neighborhood. And many of those residents were also part of the thriving, bigger African-American community in Atlanta, many of them being students and professors in the nearby Atlanta University Center. In the 1950s and 60s, we have the rise of the civil rights movement, and really a time for student nonviolent direct action across class and across generational lines, and students really taking a human rights approach, particularly challenging what in the U.S. is actually a form of apartheid. Now, some scholars critique some of the approaches in Atlanta as what they call the Atlanta style, because some of the civil rights actions in Atlanta were actually championed by the black business and civic elites without engaging the broader working and poor populations. And some of these actions were more paternalistic, and at times there were backdoor negotiations going on between the black business elite and the white elite at the expense of the working class. Also during this time, in the late 60s, there were protests in southwest Atlanta, particularly in the neighborhoods of Summerhill, Peoples Town, and Dixie Hills. However, around this time in the late 60s, there were mass uprisings in many urban centers across the United States. Atlanta's did not increase to the rate in other cities, partly because of this Atlanta paradox. And so the city administration, as well as local advocates, were saying, we don't want this to be like a Watts. We don't want this to be like a Detroit. So the protests and the activism were actually thwarted because of this this thought that the other uprisings in other cities were bad, and we do not want our uprisings to be that bad. We don't want shotguns and tear gases here in Atlanta. We actually want to frame a lot of the development that happened on the heels of the civil rights movement and afterwards to the present day as neoliberalism, and really frame neoliberalism as a form of violence, being public health practitioners, and a form of structural violence. So what happened across the nation, but particularly in Atlanta, the form of white flight, and Atlanta really being not just the city too busy to hate, but the city too busy moving to hate. So you really had sprawl happening with mass migration of white residents from inner city Atlanta to the suburbs, and metro Atlanta growing from two counties to now over nine counties in Atlanta. This really contributing to further segregation of the housing and school districts in Atlanta. Also, the school segregation and desegregation policies happening in Atlanta in the 1960s and the 1970s, where you have segregation in housing also contributing to segregation in schooling. The crack epidemic, which happened on national proportions, but also contributing to black flight, not just white flight, particularly black middle-class flight. And really the destruction of black working-class neighborhoods under the guise of quote-unquote redevelopment. So you see developments such as the Braves baseball stadium, the Georgia Dome for football, as well as highway construction and downtown urban housing really decimating black houses and neighborhoods. Also, as a form of violence, particularly against black bodies, we also want to bring up to our memory the Atlanta child murders happening between 1979 and 1980, the mass murder of black children, including 14 children between the ages of 7 and 14. And some people think that these child murders, even though it did raise local and national attention, some people think that it was downplayed in the city of Atlanta for the sake of its upcoming bid for the Olympics as well as for the Democratic National Convention. So many in the room probably are familiar with Mindy Fullilove's concept of root shock and really housing displacement being root shock to neighborhoods and to communities. So we also sit in that framework. Particularly in Atlanta, the 1980s, the Model Cities Initiative was really an unfulfilled promise in Atlanta when, particularly in Southwest Atlanta, a number of single-family homes were demolished and were decimated, and a few of them were replaced. And then in the more contemporary time, and many of our colleagues at Georgia State University and at Emory University are doing work on this, by December 31st, 2009, Atlanta became the first city in the United States to eliminate all of their traditional public housing. And then more recently, the subprime loan crisis, which has led to the foreclosure crisis, and people cite Atlanta really being the canary in the mine for that, with Atlanta, particularly Southwest Atlanta, experiencing foreclosures dating back to 2007, while the rest of the nation began to experience this crisis in 2009. So we really see housing as a social determinant of health. So now Mercedes is going to frame this more as a public health issue and then talk about our study.
So some of the major public health issues in Atlanta include a lot of different respiratory infections, especially around asthma. And when you think about this, as Dr. Deal talked about sprawl and residential segregation, we see in the city of Atlanta that people of color, especially people, low-income people of color, tend to be concentrated in areas where they're exposed to the highest concentrations of environmental hazards. And so just to move forward a little bit, here we have some of the major health issues. You think about the lack of physical activity among children. Over half of children don't participate in any organized form of physical activity. You have over approximately 17% of children who are overweight or obese in the city. And when we think back to the Safe Routes Initiative, only 13% of children do some form of active transport to school. Now, when you consider that in 1969, it was almost half. So some of the main questions that we had, we wanted to look at how social and built environments influence how youth in distressed neighborhoods, such as the Pittsburgh neighborhood, navigate through these sorts of neighborhoods. We look at their perceptions, the youth's perceptions of safe havens and riskscapes in distressed neighborhoods, as well as how these perceptions may present barriers for active transport. Additionally, we look at the health implications of the foreclosure crisis in Atlanta for youth. And we also look at how different institutions within the community, within distressed communities, may have some positive impacts on youth development. So just an overview of the Pittsburgh community. It's one of the earliest or oldest Atlanta neighborhoods, and it was established on about 500 acres of land. Just for our methods, it was a community. We had a community partnership with a local middle school and a community improvement association in Pittsburgh. We had an ethnographic approach. We conducted three focus groups with approximately 40 seventh and eighth graders at Parks Middle School, a local middle school in the Pittsburgh community. Some of our major findings include the youth really reflecting on neighborhood change and how their neighborhood has changed since the foreclosure crisis really started. They say their neighborhood isn't really how it used to be and how it's changed. Also, another major implication of the foreclosure crisis is the displacement of some residents, which can lead to, and people moving in and out, this can lead to unstable neighborhoods and kind of like a lack of social cohesion in neighborhoods, because people are constantly in flux and people are moving in and out. There are new people and people are leaving. Again, we can go back to foreclosure and the amount of abandoned homes in the Pittsburgh neighborhood. These abandoned homes
bring up a lot of things that other presenters have discussed, including fear of crime, and threat to neighborhood cohesion, which can exacerbate psychosocial factors that impact health outcomes, and other concerns around neighborhood safety. Another major health implication of these foreclosures is drug use. With the lack of social support to mediate the stress brought on by the foreclosure crisis, this has led to increase in substance use. And again, it's not just the schools that are closing down. Parks Middle School, which the school where the students who participated in the focus groups attended, their school actually has closed down now. And this school closure kind of created feelings of increased vulnerability to victimization because they were going into a school that was no longer in their neighborhood. And also, this is another source of stress for the Pittsburgh community as well as the youth.
I think we're just about out of time, but in anticipation of some questions, we just want to offer youth voice as a form of resistance to these crises, as well as reiterating the source or the sense of abandonment and loss, and really situating this as a public health issue, much like some of our colleagues like Mindy Fuller-Love and Susan Sagert see foreclosures as a public health issue. And it's not just foreclosures, it's also school closures. So some education scholars really call this as slow violence in the school closures. And then lastly, I know we've had a lot of questions in the audience around abandoned homes and what is the public health intervention. In this particular community of Pittsburgh, the local community development association has actually created a community land trust where they're buying up some of the abandoned homes. And there's also been violence and sexual assault and drug abuse around the abandoned homes. The community development association has been buying up the abandoned homes. They're also in touch with many of the residents that have been displaced. So ideally, when they're rehabbing them and renting or selling the homes, the former residents can be the ones that move back in instead of in a more equitable way instead of other residents. So thank you for your time. We love Atlanta, even though we've been critical of it. And there's our contact information. So some of the youth were part of a policy brief that Kaiser Permanente has been using around safe routes to school. But part of the problem is that the school where we conducted the focus groups actually closed right after we conducted the focus groups. And so many of the adult staff and adult allies are gone. Even though the youth still live in that neighborhood, a lot of their advocates are gone from that neighborhood. I think part of the issue with that, the Pittsburgh neighborhood, it's located very closely to downtown Atlanta, so it's definitely prime real estate, but also it's a small triangle and it's cut off from some of the other amenities of the city. And so some of you might be familiar with the Beltline that's going to connect the various green spaces and parks around Atlanta in a circular fashion. It cuts off
just as Pittsburgh community is formed. And so many of the residents feel cut off for some of the more equitable and innovative interventions that are coming into the city because of where the neighborhood is situated. So there was a master plan in Pittsburgh that was revised recently, but there's also been a lot of controversy around how engaged the community members were, the community residents of the neighborhood were. Definitely. So they're very disconnected in silos. Also, Atlanta has a new superintendent and deputy superintendent, and this neighborhood has a new school board commissioner. So there might be opportunity to have some of these connections more on the table, but right now it's not on their current radar. But yes, we need to connect those silos. Thank you for bringing that up. Thank you.